We had 2 hours with Dr. Raymond Moody talking about near-death experiences, out-of-body experiences. What comes next? Now we expand it just a little bit further. Is it possible for the future to affect the present and for our present to affect our past? Retrocausality is a controversial subject and a mind bender once you stop to think about it. You know, we've all been taught since childhood that actions have reactions, that time is linear for us. It flows in one direction and only one direction, and there's no going back. And what happens tomorrow can't possibly affect what we do today because, you know, tomorrow hasn't happened yet. But what if that's wrong? What if we live in something closer to a time loop where the past, present, and future are linked inextricably, and once in a while, we get a glimpse into what is to come? You know, humans have sought glimpses of the future throughout our history, seers and psychics and prophets and forecasters. But now there's a scientific way to look at this. It's featured in a new book by Eric Wargo, who has a PhD in anthropology and writes a popular science blog called The Nightshirt. His new book is called Time Loops, and in a moment, we jump right into it. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I first heard about the book Time Loops in a review. It's something called the Magonia blog online, which covers new publications and ideas about what we would call paranormal or supernatural topics. And this writer, the reviewer, said that this is the most interesting and well-argued book about a paranormal topic that the author had ever read or had read in years. That was enough to get me interested. And then when I first cracked it open, I saw two names that jumped out at me. One was Jeffrey Kripal, who has been my guest on this program a couple of times and is one of the deepest thinkers in looking at what we would call weird subjects and sort of looking at the big picture, tying them together and making sense of them. The other name was Patrick Wiege, the editor at Anomalous Books, who was the editor for me in a project some years ago. Both of them top-notch, and I'd have to say that the people who said that Eric Wargo's book is among the best they've ever read were not wrong. Eric, welcome to the program.
Hi, George. It's great to be here.
This is a lot to chew on. And I know in that review in the Magonia blog, I'm assuming you've seen it. Warns people that there's science in this book, but it's not like equations, not enough to scare you off.
Yeah. Well. Fortunately, I'm not a mathematician either, so you know I have to like translate things into words.
You went into anthropology and I went into journalism, and I think we probably were both trying to avoid math, right?
Exactly, exactly.
So a lot of the ideas you write in this book came from your blog, your site. Tell me about that. How that discussion started?
Yeah, that's an interesting story. Interesting paranormal story. I actually started a blog in 2006, but I didn't really, you know, I was mostly writing about science fiction at that point. And then I saw a couple of UFOs in 2009. And within the space of a month, they weren't anything, you know, particularly, you know, they weren't super close encounters. They were, you know, sort of lights in the sky type things, but that sort of got me reading about the subject. I was pretty ignorant about the whole topic of UFOs at that point. And inevitably, when you go down the rabbit hole of reading about UFOs, you sooner or later come to the works of Jacques Vallée. And he, you know, his writings are just fascinating. And he linked UFOs to psychic phenomena, which is a weird, counterintuitive thing if you don't know much about the subject. But I just found that very intriguing because although I'd never been a skeptic really about UFOs particularly, I was really pretty much a skeptic about ESP and things like that at that point. I mean, my education was pretty standard materialist, you know, scientific and so forth. And so I just, you know, I didn't really... I don't know. I had trouble buying, you know, the reality of ESP. But the more I read in that subject, the more that subject really captured my attention even more than the UFO stuff. And I wound up reading and blogging about parapsychology pretty heavily. And the more I delved into into the topic, the more the specific subject of precognition really captured my interest. And at the same time, I was at that point noticing that I was having precognitive experiences. And I'm one of the arguments I make in the book is that, you know, we're all precognitive. I mean, precognition is basic to our cognition, basically. And we just don't notice it. And fortunately, I had a long history of recording my dreams, not with any thought of studying dream precognition. I was interested in Freud, you know, way back when I was in graduate school. I'd been keeping a dream journal ever since. And I started noticing, you know, it doesn't occur to people to look for evidence of precognitive dreaming unless you're, you know, that's a possibility in your head. Well, once the moment I started reading about precognition, I was noticing that I was having precognitive dreams. And so that's basically what I've been writing about on the blog, and then wound up writing a book about it.
Well, it's audacious in a way for you to challenge basic concepts that we are all taught from kids. Cause and effect, I mean, is the simplest way to put it. You know, it's been, as you write, it's dominated Western thought and scientific thought basically forever, hundreds of years anyway. But and effect may not be what it seems, huh?
That's right. Well, I mean, you know, there's always been this notion, you know, until about 300 years ago, until Newton, you know, until the Enlightenment, you know, the idea of teleology and teleological causation was always on the table. I mean, that was always part of what made the world work. It wasn't just, you know, causes sort of pushing from the past, sort of mechanistically, which are now called efficient causes. But there was also the sense of purpose and destiny, and you know, it was maybe linked to, you know, God's plan for the universe or whatever. And that idea was really booted out by Newton and by the Enlightenment and the methods of science at the time, because it smacked of this divine causation, the idea of God. Well, you know, the whole idea was to, you know, scientifically study the universe and see if you can explain things without invoking, you know, a God sort of directing things, and so. You know, it became sort of almost the central article of faith for science for the last 300 years, that there are not teleological factors in things, that the destiny of matter is not a relevant factor in determining the present configuration of things. It's all kind of like a billiard ball. It's like balls on a billiard ball table, you know, hitting each other in sequence, and that's it. You know, and then certainly, you know, science made a lot of progress for a while, you know, operating under that assumption. And certainly, you know, science and technology, you know, leapt forward from that point. But, you know, eventually paradigms sort of run out, and anomalies, you know, you can't keep ignoring them. And that's what I'm writing about in this book is the anomalies that have just persisted, and that science is lately having to address and deal with. And it's becoming clear that causality does work in both directions, not just one. But the way they work is not symmetrical, and it's not, you know, we're not talking about divine causation or some, you know, divine plan for things. We're talking about the physical world, you know, acting back on itself in these time loops that I described.
Well, give me the thumbnail sketch of time loops and what you mean, and then we'll dig down into the specifics. But you write, you know, we may be on the verge of a massive shift in how we view time, causality, and information. So what do you mean by that, and what is a time loop?
Well, what I mean by a time loop is, and I'm sort of, one of the big objections that people have to the idea of precognition and retrocausation is inevitably people will raise you know, the objection, well, what about paradoxes? What about, like, the grandfather paradox, which is classic from science fiction? You know, a time traveler travels into the past and kills his grandfather. You know, well, what happens then? You know, how could then he, you know, live to go in the time machine and go back in time? You know, it's like somehow the idea of anything that any kind of reversed causation invites this idea of paradox. Well, what I'm arguing in the book is that's grandfather paradox is a big nothing burger. There's really actually no possibility of that. And in fact, physicists who've studied, for instance, the possibility of wormholes, the possibility of time traveling objects in wormholes, have done the math and figured out that the universe is going to be self-consistent, which means that all those paths through space-time that would result in something preventing itself, like a grandfather paradox, can't happen. But you can still have retrocausation. You can still have time travel, in fact. And what it turns out is that whatever travels back in time contributes, facilitates its own traveling back in time in a big loop. Physicists call it a closed time-like curve. That's the technical term. The actually colloquial term is self-fulfilling prophecy when you're talking about precognition. I just use the word time loop because it's a catchy phrase, but the point is you can't change the past. You can't change a previously existing past, but you can influence the past. You can shape the past. And that's an important but subtle distinction that takes, you know, a few hundred pages to explain.
Yeah, and we'll cover it. It's a great premise for sci-fi type movies and projects. I watched a time loop movie. I'm trying to remember what it was on Netflix two nights ago, where some guys go into a UFO death cult and they find out they're trapped in a time loop. It's a great premise and device for telling a story.
Sure.
But you take it so much further. It's not just a story, that it explains a lot of what happens to humans all over the world. The idea of precognition, we get glimpses of what happens in the future, but we don't recognize that it was precognition until what we saw actually occurs, right?
Right, exactly. And it's unconscious. That's the key point. When you're talking about, you know, sentient creatures like us who are, you know, we're conscious and aware of our lives and everything, you know, when we're freely willed, you know, we can act on the basis of our insights. We can't have a premonition that's clear about an event that we could truly prevent. And so it's a very common experience for people to have premonitory dreams or precognitive dreams about disasters that they can't prevent. And often they have a reaction, well, my God, you know, why did I have this dream about this thing if I can't prevent it? But it's just, that's precisely the point, I believe, that precognition gives us, it really gives us it gives us foreknowledge or a foresense, maybe, or sort of guides us past disasters, and not just disasters, but crises and upheavals in our lives. And they can be very minor upheavals. I mean, just the sink backing up or, you know, dropping, you know, breaking your favorite mug. I mean, these are actual examples of precognitive dreams I've had, but there's a common theme to precognitive experiences. They all involve some kind of slight upheaval or major upheaval.
You mean in our lives, something that's going on?
Yes, in our lives. Yes. Yes.
So you write about, early in the book, about a Washington, D.C. software engineer and artist in her mid-30s who you call Anne, mm-hmm. who told you in an interview about a series of things that happened to her. Can you share that story?
Yeah. This came out, you know, totally by accident. You know, I'd actually already written most of this book, and I was, you know, sharing, you know, I was talking about it with her, and she said, oh my God, you know, this happens to me, you know? And so she told me a few very interesting stories, and these were all dreams that she had had in her 20s, specifically about people. They were all about deaths of people that she knew, in some cases, not people who she was very close to. In one case, she, you know, dreamed about the father of her then boyfriend, I believe, in college, who was, and she saw him on the steps of her college library, and he was waving goodbye to her, and then the next day found out that he had died. And she had a dream about a friend of hers that she had lost touch with, an old friend of hers. Actually, I think it was a series of dreams where she saw the friend's house, family house from the air, and it just felt very like a feeling of foreboding, like something was wrong. And soon thereafter, she found out that her friend had overdosed. Another case, her roommate woke up and went past her roommate's room, and he was packing to leave somewhere, and she asked where he was going. He said, well, my uncle died, and I'm going home to the funeral. And she said, oh, I'm terribly sorry. And she went back to bed. Well, she woke up then an hour later or so and went past his room, and he was there packing his bags just as he had been an hour ago. And she said, well, I'm really sorry once again to hear about your uncle. And he looked at her like, how did you know that? I didn't tell you about my uncle. And she realized that she'd been dreaming the first time. She had had a precognitive dream about an event happening about an hour later. And this happens. One of the interesting aspects of this phenomenon is that, you know, we don't realize we're doing this. We don't realize that we're precognitive. And so when weird, uncanny experiences like that occur, and more commonly when just what we typically call synchronicities occur, you know, meaningful coincidences, we have no idea that it's our own brains orienting us towards certain situations. And then we find ourselves in this, you know, strange circumstance. It's almost, I sometimes think of it as crashing a party and then finding out that you were on the guest list, you know, these kind of feeling, you know, weird experiences in which the world seems to somehow expect our arrival.
There's a story you tell in the book about Jeff Kripal, and he's working on a project, and he gets an envelope of stuff from somebody in the Pentagon, I guess, about UFOs. Mm-hmm. And he does not open it.
Well, that's just it. He remembered opening it and knew what it contained. It was a story about a guy's levitation experience, okay? Well, he didn't have time to, like, read or reply to it, so he just stuffed it in his scheduler or whatever and then left to go on vacation. And when he came back from vacation, he, you know, opened his schedule book or whatever and found the envelope, but it was sealed. It was not open the way he'd remembered. And he was kind of perplexed. He examined the envelope and it was completely sealed. And so he unsealed it again, you know, and read the letter. And it was, again, it was exactly what he remembered.
He knew what it was, even though he had not opened it. He was wrong about opening it. We're talking with Eric Wargo about his book, Time Loops. His new book that looks at the idea is that precognition, it might be not just a coincidence, not just an incident of synchronicity, but maybe the future you sending you a message essentially back through time. Maybe the best way to get our heads around that would be to look at some of the times when this has popped up in very dramatic ways in catastrophes such as the Titanic, 9-1-1, and involving some of the most famous people in the world. We're going to get into those cases in just a moment here on Coast to Coast AM. Eric Orgo, I think most in our audience can get their heads around the idea of precognitive glimpses, that maybe we somehow psychically get a view of what the future might hold for us, even though we don't realize it until it actually comes to pass. Your suggestion is that happens to us all the time, more often than we realize. The idea, though, that the future can affect what's going on now, the present, is a lot harder to get our heads around. Maybe the way to explain it is to relate some of the examples you have in the book about precognitive splashes that have been made. The Titanic is a great example that you go into in detail. Tell me a bit about that.
Yeah, sure. The Titanic disaster, lots of people afterwards reported various sort of psychic phenomena around the Titanic disaster. And, you know, many of them interpreted it as telepathy or whatever. That was sort of the dominant theory of psychic phenomena at the time. But, you know, most of them, you know, in hindsight, you know, look like cases of precognition. For instance, several examples were compiled by Ian Stevenson in the 1960s, and a businessman who was supposed to sail on the Titanic was having terrible dreams in the weeks leading up to the ship sailing, and in the dreams the ship was sinking and he was, you know, in a crowd of people in the water. And he fortunately got a telegram from his business associates telling him to postpone his trip. So he, you know, very thankfully canceled his booking and, of course, lived to tell the tale. A lot of people who sailed on the Titanic had dreams about it beforehand that they didn't heed. And people just randomly around the world had psychic experiences about it. For instance, a woman had, you know, very vivid, on the night that of the Titanic sank, she had very vivid, woke from a vivid nightmare of people hanging on a steeply inclined railing in terror. And this, the thing is, this matched the pictures that were the illustrations that were reproduced in newspapers in the coming weeks of the Titanic disaster. So, just lots of people had dreams and visions related to it.
Of course, you don't know until it happens, and then you have to worry about people who make it up afterwards so they look like they're psychics.
Absolutely, this is always, and this is the very thorny problem when studying precognition. And it's one of the reasons that this has been such a kind of forbidden territory for scientists. Not forbidden, but people don't want to venture into it because there are these problems that so many precognitive dreams are only recorded after the fact, or, you know, these stories are often told afterwards. The thing is, there are lots of exceptions to that, however, a lot more than you'd think. More people than you imagine keep dream journals, for instance. And also, it doesn't only occur with things like dreams. The most famous Titanic prophecy was a novel that was published, I think, 14 years before the disaster in 1898, by a man named Morgan Robertson. He was a sort of a sci-fi adventure storyteller, and he wrote a novel called Futility, and it was about an ocean liner called Titan that strikes an iceberg in the North Atlantic on an April night and goes down, and everybody dies, or almost everybody dies because there aren't enough lifeboats. And that's just sort of there's more to the story. It was sort of that's kind of the premise for the ongoing adventures of this one character. But, you know, that's a pretty uncanny pretty uncanny coincidence, if you want to call it that. There are a lot of, but the thing is, there are tons of cases like that in literature. I mean, artists, you know, you could say that literature, writing, that art in generally is kind of dreaming. It's a kind of form of dreaming, essentially, and you're channeling your unconscious inspirations. And writers are constantly writing things that then come true either in their lives or in the news or whatever sometime thereafter. So there are lots of lots of cases that you can actually study and know for certain that you're not dealing with someone changing things after the fact or misremembering things.
It's not only writers writing things that come true, it's writers writing things that came from somewhere else. They feel like they're channeling, not writing. And the same is true, I think, for artists, painters, musicians. I know the story about Paul McCartney and Yesterday popping into his head as if written. And there are a lot of stories like that among creative people.
It's pretty universal in creative people. That experience of channeling something that just didn't come from your own head, that's really what we're talking about when we're talking about the unconscious. And this is why I spend, there's a lot of real estate in my book devoted to Sigmund Freud, because he pioneered the study of the unconscious. He didn't invent the concept, but he sort of mapped it. And so, you know, this common thing that produces dreams, but it produces, you know, slips of the tongue, produces neurotic symptoms, and it produces art and creativity. And yes, it's a universal theme in the lives of artists that when they're really cooking, you know, the stories or the images or the music doesn't come from anything that they're deciding. It's just comes to them like as though from somewhere else. Well, my argument is that the unconscious is just consciousness displaced in time. That experience of channeling something from somewhere else is that tapping into our future self.
You write about Carl Jung quite a bit, in addition to mentioning Freud, but he's the guy that first takes the deep dive into the ideas of coincidences as synchronicities. And it's because, in part, at least, some things that happened to him. This thing with the scarab, with the Beatles, for example. Tell us a little bit about Jung and his writing on this, and then give us that example.
Sure. Yeah, well, Carl Jung, I have very deeply mixed feelings about Carl Jung. I mean, I'm fascinated on the one hand, but I also feel like, I am certainly appreciative that Carl Jung's work, I think, has opened the minds of many people over the generations toward phenomena that certainly science rejects. Things like what he called synchronicity. That was from a monograph that he wrote in 1952 called Synchronicity and an A-Causal Connecting Principle. And this was his way of theorizing, kind of trying to come up with a theory to explain meaningful coincidences, which we've all experienced. You know, we all experience synchronicities. You know, you're thinking of some old friend, and suddenly you get an email from them. You know, or you know, you're just chains of events happening that don't seem, it just seem like they can't be coincidental. My problem with Jung is that he tried too hard to force these phenomena into a theory that just really doesn't make sense. He sort of tried to argue that essentially meaningful connections somehow exist in the universe outside of our own heads, and that they can kind of stage manage events in life. Now, his most famous example is a perfect example of why that theory isn't nearly as compelling as the idea of precognition, and what I call misrecognized precognition. And that's the scarab beetle story that probably most of your listeners have probably heard the story at one point or another, because it's told, you know, in pretty much, you know, in many, many books, especially New Age books and so forth. But the basic story is this young woman patient of his was in his office, and she's telling him this dream that she had the night before, that someone gave her this golden piece of jewelry shaped like an Egyptian scarab beetle. Well, just as she's telling him this dream, he hears him tapping on the window behind him, and he turns around, and there's a rose chafer beetle knocking at the window. The rose chafer is the kind of European equivalent of the scarab beetle. And so he opens the window and cups the beetle in his hand and hands it to his patient and said, "Here's your scarab." And he, you know, this moment, you know, he describes it had the effect on his patient of breaking her out of her rationalistic shell and opening her to the mysteries and so forth. Well, so he describes this as synchronicity, because what he's doing is describing it from his own point of view, which is, you know, he's sitting in the office, the woman is telling him her story about the scarab beetle, and here's a scarab at the window. And so for him, he's seeing this as these three things sort of coming together all at once. Well, that sort of has a way of distracting people from the fact that, no, what really happened was the woman had a precognitive dream of that very scene that unfolded in his office. So she had a dream the night before, you know, a few hours earlier, that then is realized in real life, and he plays a role in realizing that. So it was basically a case of precognition, and it's a perfect example of what I mean by a time loop, because it's a self-fulfilling prophecy in the sense that it only occurred because she was telling him her dream. You know, she had, you know, it was brought about by the fact that she was telling him her dream, and then he lets the beetle into the room and so forth. So it's that cyclical quality that I think that is maybe deflects people from considering precognition, because they think, well, that just doesn't make sense. You know, that's illogical. I think people tend to think another word for self-fulfilling prophecy is tautology. And I think people link that with paradox. They think it's the same thing as a paradox. And thus we're not supposed to go there in our heads, but in fact, it's the opposite of a paradox.
Yeah. You write about it in the book, a couple of places where, you know, other professional scientists get a little nervous about this whole idea, especially when the people involved play a role in what happens to them, a self-fulfilling prophecy. And you compare it to a quote from J.R.R. Tolkien, who I remember, if we're talking about seeing in the future, Galadriel, one of his main characters, she's got that talent and can look into the future. But that is a factor in why this is not looked at more seriously, I would guess.
Exactly. Exactly. There are many, many factors why this isn't taken seriously. This is part of really what my book is trying to do, is get people just to take it seriously by showing them why all the reasons they've not taken it seriously or been told not to take it seriously are mistaken or based on false assumptions. There are a lot of them.
911 is another example that you write about. There are a lot of people who had premonitions, what we would call premonitions, about 911, at least, and probably many of them are pretending that they had precognitions, but a lot of folks are fairly well documented, including an artist who was in one of the towers when the disaster occurred. Speak in general about 911 and premonitions there, and then about that artist in general.
Yes. Yeah, the Rhine Setter the famous research institute of ESP, they collect disaster precognition stories, and you know, they got more calls about people reporting 9/11 dreams and so forth than about any other disaster in their experience. Lots of people had dreams. In fact, I did. This was even before, you know, before I was even at all aware of precognitive dreaming. But on the morning before, you know, the event, I had a dream that that had, you know, elements relating to the disaster. I only realized later, I think the following day, when I went back and looked at my dream journal, I was like, "Oh, that's weird." But one of the most striking cases to my mind is the case of Michael Richards, the artist you mentioned. He was a sculptor. I think he was Jamaican, and his studio was in one of the towers. I think on the 92nd floor of one of the towers. He was tragically killed in the attacks. But his one of his most famous works is it's called Tar Baby versus Saint Sebastian, and it's a self-portrait sculpture. It's a life-size sculpture of himself in bronze, standing, you know, vertically, standing very erect and tall and straight. Almost like a building in a sense, and he's being pierced by planes, by a bunch of planes. People have, you know, made a big deal that, like, wow, this is it seems like another case of precognition. And adding to it, people who knew him and had visited his studio reported that actually some of his latest works that he had done just before he died were of the same theme of him being pierced by planes and planes crashing and stuff like that. So he was clearly gripped by some kind of obsession, artistic obsession, of being pierced by planes. And then he died when his building was you know, crashed into by planes. So. But there are many other, you know, lots of other people reported, you know, similar things, or they, after the fact, they told about dreams. And, you know, it's like, I'm skeptical of the skeptics who say, well, you know, if they reported the dream after the fact, well, they're probably making it up. I'm really skeptical that there are that many people who really want to make up stories like that. You know, there's not much to be gained in this world by pretending to be psychic. It's
Does Ryan collect these stories ahead of time? I mean, do you just send prophecies to them?
I don't know if they tally them and compare. I don't know how many of the stories they collected were beforehand or after. I don't think they collect the story beforehand. Okay. I mean, it wouldn't occur to people to report disaster premonitions generally, unless they were very specific.
I think it'd be a great experiment, wouldn't it? Just to go ahead and send us your disaster predictions, and then you catalog them, and then afterward you can figure out who got it right.
Yeah, I think that kind of experiment has been done, but that would be interesting to do.
Eric Wargo, we're talking about time loops with the author of this book. It's mind-bending stuff. And when we come back, we're going to jump into some other examples. Norman Mailer comes to mind.